From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Natasha Rothwell was unforgettable as Kelly on HBO's Insecure and as a beleaguered spa manager in The White Lotus. She's also in the new Sonic the Hedgehog sequel. Now with her own production company and an overall deal at ABC Signature, she's planning to create movies and TV that skip the tired tropes and put diverse people at the center of the story.
I think so many scripts use page real estate, you know, in Act One just to justify someone's blackness or fatness or womanness. And then the story can start, right? We have to like acclimate the audience to our otherness before we can tell a story. And I think that's bullshit.
Natasha Rothwell talks about blossoming in the Insecure writer's room and plans for her company, Big Hattie Productions. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So I have been through or experienced and enjoyed the Top Gun premiere in the recent days in San Diego. You know, there is no star who can pull off a thing like this that I can think of. I mean, with the helicopter and the hoopla, like a three-hour red carpet press touring an aircraft carrier, a decommissioned one, I will note, an auditorium full of people from the Navy base here in their whites. You know, this is such a throwback to the original Top Gun. Kenny Loggins was in the audience,
Oh, wow.
And it certainly felt like an old school, as Tom Cruise said at the beginning, he did these remarks. Tom Cruise is, he's so immaculately polite. He gets up on the stage. He thanks Sherry Redstone, who was there, Bob Bakish, who was there. Of course, everybody else, has the cast stand up, has the Navy people stand up. It is safe to say the crowd went wild. I'm not touting this movie, although I think we can both afford to say it's a pretty fun ride.
I'll tout it. It's great. Come on.
I'm not a critic. But it's fun. And, it's an old-fashioned PG-13 thing. And for me, I mean, dating myself, I go back to the days when Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer, and not when they made this movie, because that's before my time, but when they were at their deal at Paramount making really big blockbusters on the regular, they had this joint desk. They had a shared desk in the Paramount offices. And Don Simpson was this, he's kind of a legendary producer, a lot of drugs, a lot of, let's just say it, hookers and all kinds of crazy lifestyle stuff, but was a really, really important source for me and taught me Hollywood. I have to say it was a little bit an emotional thing to see Don Simpson credited. He died years ago. And, for Jerry Bruckheimer, who was there, his partner, he's had an amazing post-Don career. They broke up because of the bad habits in the day. But, it was an emotional kind of thing of there's Don's name on the credits. And Don's brother was there at the party and the premiere. So that is old school Hollywood, and they're going to go around the world. They're headed to Mexico City. There's going to be a royal premiere in London and then Cannes and this and that. I mean, it's a wild, wild ride. I'll note the previous regime at Paramount set all this in motion. That movie has been held because of the pandemic. Now the question we face with that movie at the end of the month and Doctor Strange just coming up, are the movies back?
That's a good question. I think, first of all, it's the ultimate flex for a producer to get a credit at 26 years after dying. So congrats to Don Simpson for that one. But I think this is a big question right now. We have the Marvel movie, Doctor Strange. We have Top Gun. We have, the parade of summer pre-branded sequels and spin-off blockbuster type movies. But is this going to be a return to normal? Finally, is this, we can stop talking about, that's a good opening for the pandemic. Is it just going to be a good opening, period? That's the big question. I've seen some conflicting data this week on whether people think that audiences are going to return in the 2019 style box office. And I don't know the answer to that. I think four specific movies, for the 5 to 10 movies we have still to come out this year that are guaranteed, Spider-Man No Way Home type pre-branded, going to be big movies? Yes. But the middle has really fallen out of this market, and studios are so skittish on sending those, you know, original dramas and, you know, lesser tier action movies to the theaters. And they have not shown yet that the audience is willing to come out for those movies yet.
Yeah. And, you know, older audiences, we have a lot of confusion with the, you know, COVID isn't over. We've seen people get sick after the White House Correspondents' Weekend with all those parties, a gridiron dinner. You know, this is an ongoing concern. I was one of the only people wearing a mask in a very large auditorium full of people at this Top Gun premiere. So I would expect some results from that. Unfortunately, I'm not making light of it, but, you know, people don't want to continue with mandates. So that's where we are. And that may be a problem for this industry.
It may. And I think the big test will actually not be the Marvel movie or Top Gun. It will be Downton Abbey. There's a Downton Abbey movie set to come out May 20th. And that's the first real test, I think, of a franchise that skews heavily older, and whether the audience will show up for that movie, which has been delayed. And, you know, they feel that it is the right time to put out that movie now at Universal. Whether people show up is a big open question.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the ideal test, since I feel like, you know, I don't think they've gotten better with repeat outings. But, you know, there's a lot to be revealed. I think there is an appetite to get out of the house. And I think certainly younger audiences are going to turn out in droves. But we'll see. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. One of the funniest characters in recent TV memory was the uncensored, loyal, and quick-witted Kelly on HBO's Insecure. The show followed the lives, loves, and lusts of four girlfriends in Los Angeles for five seasons. Natasha Rothwell was a writer on the series before she was tapped to play Kelly, and she also became a producer and director on the Issa Rae show.
Oh, I've always believed in you, love. You've got that American entrepreneurial spirit.
What are you doing?
My new beau, Darnell, is showing me Los Angeles.
I faked an accent when we met, and now I have to commit. Don't make it weird.
Darnell, darling!
With a dad in the Air Force, Natasha Rothwell moved around often as a kid. She learned to ingratiate herself by being funny, but she did not initially set her sights on show business. So you at one point were interested in journalism, but I've read that you were putting in too many words, strongly opinionated words.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I always loved writing, and I was afraid to commit to theater for college. And I had, I guess, in a very dramatic fashion, which was very apropos, concocted this drama that my parents would be, you know, upset if I majored in theater. And so I decided to major in journalism, which felt like the next best thing. And when you're taking journalism classes as a freshman, and, you know, I had to write pieces that were without my opinion in it, and I struggled with that. And I finally told my parents, you know, very dramatically that I was going to major in theater, and they were relieved. They were like, we knew you were an actor. We knew that you've all, like, you know, from the time you were little, this is clearly what you've been called to do. We just want you to be happy. And so transferred schools and switched my major.
Still daunting as a career.
Yeah. I mean, very recently, I was watching an interview with Viola Davis and heard her say that her dreams were bigger than her fears. And it resonated with me on a soul level, because that's what it felt like. I mean, I was terrified. As someone who loves certainty, it's kind of ridiculous that this is what I do for a living. But I felt like my dreams sort of pushed me past my fears of that uncertainty.
So you then taught, and you taught your kids, I read, Neil Simon plays, like, yeah, these were lots of kids of color, not a group of white kids, but you didn't yes. want to do the, you know, the thing that many people would just do, which is something by some so-called black material.
Yeah, I mean, I did theater classes in high school myself, and actually got pushed into creative writing because I was writing monologues for myself, because I didn't want to do yet another, you know, Lorraine Hansberry or, you know, Into Saki Shange, like, for colored girls. And I'd done it all. And so for me, it was just like, I wanted to not be limited by how I'm being perceived. And I wanted the opportunity to explore, you know, all ideas, regardless of who penned the work, because when you have a person of color saying those words, it's inherently a Black performance. And so, you know, cut 2 years later, I was, you know, teaching high school theater for 4 years in the Bronx. And I had always loved, you know, Neil Simon and Odd Couple, and Rumours was a really sort of kid-friendly play. And I wanted to have my kids explore this. And I wanted to do that only because I'm very, very subversive and I love, you know, subverting expectations and everything I do. I think it's kind of a hallmark of the things that I'm drawn to generally. And I didn't present it to them as, you know, this big subversive thing that I was doing. It was just, oh, this is the play that Ms. Rothwell selected, and they did it and they killed it. It was just, it was a delight to do.
Yeah. I wonder if you learned more in that teaching experience, like about how to handle children when you came to Hollywood, or stuff about drama, you know?
Oh, man. Yes. I think that the politics of the high school theater department definitely prepared me for some future shenanigans. But it's cliche to say, but they really did teach me and push me to pursue my passion, because I wasn't, you know, teaching theater in lieu of, you know, chasing my dreams. It was just, I couldn't do it full time. And so it was this really weird sort of, you know, teacher by day and doing comedy by night and writing by night. And after 4 years, and, you know, I felt more and more fraudulent, because I'm telling these kids who are at that time, you know, applying to their colleges to go after their dreams, and I felt stalled. And so I quit, and I went from having, you know, basically that steady job to the gig economy. And I worked all over New York. I was a nanny. I babysat. I did other teaching artist gigs that were more flexible. And I'm so grateful that it worked out.
Right. So you had this short, and I guess not tremendously happy, you auditioned for SNL, and they didn't put you on the air, but they put you in the writer's room. And I guess you felt just not included in the conversation. Something that changes when you get to Insecure. And I read where Prentice Penny, who's actually been a guest on the show, said that you would raise your hand when you got to the Insecure writer's room. And he would be like, why are you raising your hand? But that's something that was a hangover from an experience on SNL.
I mean, I think, you know, to speak more broadly, I think, you know, when you go from your very first writer's room into your second, it's only then you recognize what is typical and then what is atypical, right? Because you see sort of like a pattern emerge. And so I think that, you know, the hierarchy at SNL isn't, you know, a secret, and it's very much common knowledge. And I was aware of my position in the writer's room. And I think being the only one in that room with, you know, brown titties, it made me like even more aware of where I stood. And so yeah, going into the Insecure writer's room, I came in very deferential, and I didn't want to speak out of turn. And it was Prentice and Issa shut that down very quickly. And it was, you know, it felt very much like King Arthur's round table, and I felt like an equal, and I felt that my words mattered, and I didn't have to prove anything before they considered them. And I think that, you know, so much of one's experience at SNL is, you know, they say there's always three sides to everything, your version, their version, and the truth. And so I think that somewhere between my experience and the truth, there's room to grow for their writer's room culture. And from what I hear, and I don't really, I'm not in tons of communication with folks still on the show, but from what I understand, there's changes happening, and that's good to hear. You know, I think a 40 plus year old institution has to keep up with the times and have their room and their cast reflect the world we live in.
I can't imagine what a relief it was to come into the Insecure writer's room after at least the short period of being scared, basically.
I mean, it was definitely, it feels almost sort of like karmically. I was thrown a bone after having gone through, you know, SNL. And All that said, you know, and I'm not saying this to sort of pussyfoot around anything, you know, I'm genuinely grateful for my time at SNL, and I cut my teeth there and worked with some of the most amazing comedic minds and wrote so many sketches. It's where I learned to be prolific and not perfect. And I'm so glad for those things. But, you know, there is that relief of when you walk into a room in a space and the energy is just more your speed, and you feel like there's a shorthand because, you know, you don't have to explain yourself in so many ways. So yeah, it was the best kind of like, you know, culture shock getting back into it.
Right. And I, if I'm remembering it right, you were a writer initially on Insecure, not cast.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I mean, how did you manage to secure that gig?
I mean, it's so funny. Even the word manage, it was not in my plan or in my purview at all. I was, again, having come from the SNL writer's room, which is a sketch room, into sort of a traditional writer's room, I wanted to make sure that I did that right. And so I was, you know, my nose was in the books and I had no idea that they had even, you know, were even considering me for that. But Issa and Prentice, as a part of their writer's room process, would have the writers read the script aloud, and she would just randomly assign, you know, different characters. One week, you know, I would read Molly, the next week I would read Tiffany, and then, you know, I was assigned Kelly once she was created, because she wasn't even, you know, developed until, I want to say, maybe the first 2 months into the writer's room. And then I kept being cast as Kelly at the internal read, and Kelly again and Kelly again. And I didn't even suspect that that was anything. I just know that I can turn a joke and I have I had fun, you know, that was the end of it for me. And then Issa and Prentice called me into their office, and I 100% thought I was in trouble. I was just like, oh no, I've made one too many dick jokes at the table. It's over for me. It's curtains. And they're just like, you know, we would really love for you to play Kelly on the show. And I immediately burst into tears. you know, of course, accepted, and even at that time, it was just a guest starring role. I wasn't a series regular at that point. I didn't know how far it would go or what the role would become. I was just grateful to be seen. And I tell Issa all the time, you know, that her ability to see creators in their totality is something that I want to be able to do for others. And because it changed my life in no uncertain terms.
Now, so you've done a lot of acting gigs. You know, you're now in Sonic 2, but the one I'm going to talk about right now is White Lotus, which was great performance, amazing performance.
Thank you.
And a very different world. I mean, it's the guy's literally named Mike White. You know?
Right, right, right.
That's how white it was. That's his name.
Yeah, there you go.
When you segue back, you know, are you now so confident having been Kelly? And I know you, I know you'd mentioned that people think you are Kelly and you're not, because you're just not. You say you're an introverted person, and maybe you feel a weight of expectation walking into a room that people are like, Kelly's here. But yeah. What was it like? I now have been this character and this writer on this amazing show, and all that diffidence has faded.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I think in the public eye, it was a role and a show that, you know, seems, you know, antithetical to things that I'd done in the past. But like I mentioned, you know, I ended up going to theater school proper and was classically trained. And when I graduated, at that point, I had done more dramatic roles than comedic roles, and actually resisted comedy for quite a bit because I didn't believe it to be legitimate or serious. You know, I was judging it pretty hard. And my professor at the time, after I graduated, my mentor, we met for coffee, and I complained about, like, you know, I was getting a lot of comedic roles on the stage and in and around DC. And he was just like, you know, it's a gift what you have, and you need to not resist it. You need to hone it, and you need to, you know, explore it. And so all of that to say, you know, once the White Lotus came around, it felt like a homecoming for me, you know, to be able to do a role in which I wasn't the one, you know, turning all the jokes, and I was able to sort of ground her and play something more subtle. And it was such fun for me.
Coming up after the break, Natasha Rothwell talks about honoring actress Hattie McDaniel by naming her company after her. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with actress, writer, director, and producer Natasha Rothwell, who was unforgettable as the hilarious Kelly on HBO's Insecure. She's had a busy few years acting, writing, and producing for TV. Through her company, Big Hattie Productions, she has an overall deal with ABC Signature and plans to produce stories that center marginalized voices. Rothwell is an outspoken activist who regularly shares her thoughts on Twitter. Almost every day since last year, for example, she's been tweeting succinctly, "You are trash," to Georgia Governor Brian Kemp. In the HBO limited series The White Lotus, Rothwell played Belinda, the spa manager at an exclusive Maui resort. Jennifer Coolidge played a lonely, wealthy woman who promised to help Belinda fulfill her dream of starting her own business.
You know, what would be really exciting for me would be to make it a holistic experience. Spiritual therapies and body treatments, and I would love, 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 love to make it so women from all economic backgrounds could benefit, you know, not just rich women. Not that there's anything wrong with rich women, I just, you know what I mean.
Rothwell and White Lotus creator Mike White had conversations about the right way to treat the character.
What was on the page was exceptional, or I wouldn't have said yes to it, but it does change what's being said by who's saying it. And so it wasn't necessarily me saying, like, I wanted him to, you know, make sure that it was, he did it right. I think I wanted to make sure that I did right by Belinda and making sure that when you do have a Black character in a mostly, you know, homogenous environment in a subservient position, that it doesn't fall prey to, you know, stereotypes and various antiquated tropes. And it wasn't on the page, but it doesn't even need to be on the page for that to be sort of like in the spirit of how she's seen. Right. And so the conversations that I had with Mike were incredible. He was so excited, and he knew I was a writer as well. And I think that we bonded on more than anything of just, we would nerd out over dialogue and, you know, small, subtle aspects. I remember telling him, you know, at one point in the show, Belinda has a phone call with her son. And I told him, when we met in Hawaii, we, you know, had a meeting, and I was just like, Black people talk different when no white people are around. And I was like, and he was so excited by, like, he, like, those are the small subtleties that he wasn't aware of, you know what I mean? Or just like, maybe he's aware of, but just realizing the practical applications of that, of just like, oh, this is a moment where we get to see her exhale. And like, we have that opportunity. And so he allowed me to sort of put my stank on it. And I'm so grateful. I think directors that really listen and understand, and, you know, understand their limitations and cast, you know, diverse actors and bring them into the process should be truly celebrated, because I think it's meaningful.
You mentioned the idea of tropes, and you've named your production company Big Hattie as, I guess, a nod to, obviously, Hattie McDaniel, who won the Oscar for Gone with the Wind.
That's right.
I feel like there's an homage in there that you want to recognize her work and what she had to deal with.
Absolutely. I think that for a myriad of reasons, I mean, she's a woman of color. She's a plus size woman of color. And her career is, you know, defined by those tropes. And if it weren't for her, if it weren't for women like her that suffered through, you know, stereotypical roles and scripts and, you know, that type of thing, like, I wouldn't be here. And I want to be able to, like I said, subvert expectations. So I want to be able to produce, write, direct, and act in things under Big Hattie Productions that aren't trauma drama or, you know, pain porn or, you know, seeing someone who looks like me with a limited familiar view. I wanted to really create a company that was going to subvert those expectations that would challenge the way that we're seen and allow us to be human at the, you know, on page one. I think so many scripts use page real estate, you know, in act one just to justify someone's blackness or fatness or womanness. And then the story can start, right? We have to, like, you know, acclimate the audience to our otherness before we can tell a story. And I think that's bullshit. I think that we are human and we are whole and we can start the story on the first page. And so in honor of Hattie and for all the other Hatties out there, I want to be a source of work that puts that into the universe, you know?
Yeah. You did your deal at ABC. You have an overall deal at ABC. And I don't know. It's a Disney company, obviously, and they've been dealing with all of this stuff in Florida. I mean, I am going to assume that you were just going to do your work and I'm sure there was a moment there where you were wondering what was going on. Like a lot of people associated with Disney were, but at this point, Disney's taken its position, dealing with this fight now, in Florida, and you're just going to do your work.
Yeah. I mean, it's doing my work, but I think I'm outspoken and politically active outside of, you know, my vocation. And so I was very vocal about what DeSantis is doing in Florida in the Don't Say Gay bill and will continue to be. I think for me, Disney knows what they're getting. I feel really grateful too. You know, my acquisition at Disney is under Tara Duncan, who's an incredible woman of color, who's the president of Freeform and the head of Onyx Collective, which is a brand, which is just like the brand of FX or, you know, Hulu, a new brand under Disney that's dedicated to putting marginalized voices in the forefront. And so that to me was my entry point. That to me sort of made jumping into sort of the waters at Disney much more, palatable, for the lack of a better word. And so I'm excited to create under, you know, the Onyx label there. And I think, you know, for me, and much like, you know, Kerry Washington posted on Instagram too, there's no gag order from, you know, the Disney higher ups that we can't be vocal about what we disagree with, even if it is the parent company. And I think that, you know, they need to do what's right and it should do. And so I'll continue working for sure, but I'll also continue fighting.
Natasha Rothwell is a writer, director, and actress. Her latest film is Sonic the Hedgehog 2. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
And that's The Business. Melissa Yeager-Miller produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.